with the radio spark. Meet me where the most light falls. You are listening to Where the Most Light Falls with DJ Tamara on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. Introductory music provided by purpleplanet.com. Welcome to Where the Most Light Falls, an audio literary journal. Today I'll be sharing some poetry and other kinds of literature, and I will be featuring some guest poets and writers reading their own work and translated work. Today's featured authors include Louisa Campbell, Dave Kavanaugh, Tracy Clapper, Christina Rivera Garza, translated from the Spanish by Julia Liberone, Karen Bims, Tasha Borst, Wanda Conway, Skip Bolden, Caroline McHugh, Dawn Reno Langley, and Scott Hutchison. Today's background music is provided by David Fedeli. It's an album of minimalist piano called Synapsis. And the first reading will be an Irish version of my poem called My Mother's Birthplace, which was chosen as one of the finalists in the O'Bell International Contest for 2018. My friend Jenny Nirosel was so kind to record it for me in Irish. I will follow it with my reading in English.
Chanter Dukus Mawahir. Hew my heart, Ermalia, Gulshir or Wohrinus Mointe. Roger Mawahir and Shaw. Tabala Isho Markiovus Lushengoson. Binis the Glor, Dor. Shost scale nar in Shiogafo. Smaid Shirm, Yelanid. Hangamer Temple Kursawahir. Nero Erdus Chakawan Elalafeka Galam Gwit Hit Brat Kyo Ernislate Hyuntik Shian Lampa Erhaig As Kirky Hanag Mahinshir Hanag Shit Gagarad in Yehela Lean Bill Kuratori Spirit Nashinshir Fuwalert Klo Shin Shin Shanwaher Shin Shin Shanaher Armrahra Celtica Dimishishis and Boher, her loose lasrock. The Aquids Gruga, Ig Imot Lagui. Naim Shid Lakela, Fain, Ina Enakela, Remade Do Inchta.
My mother's birthplace. I walked around the town to go back in time. My mother was born here. A low wall edges the path. It took her a long time to answer. The sweetness of her voice, teardrop. This is an untold story, She beckoned for me to follow. We came around a bend in the road. There wasn't another house in sight. I swear to you, my mother's grave, a blanket of fog fell over the mountains. She angled the lamp towards her face. My ancestors came from Cork. They came in close succession. A trickle of visitors, ancestral spirits, transformed. Great-great-grandmother, great-great-grandfather, our Celtic cousins. She flew down the road. Her hair was flying in the wind. They embraced, inexpressible joy. Happy late Mother's Day to all the mothers out there, and to all the daughters and granddaughters, and anyone who has ever had a mother figure. Now we'll have a poem by Patricia, known as P.J. Temple. The poem is Hummingbird's Secret.
The Hummingbird's Secret. We flit swiftly around each other like blind hummingbirds, pretending we can't see the longing in our quivering mouths. Quick, breathless glances, relieved to see each other as though we've traveled through worlds of agonizing distance and time apart, now locked like a neuron perfectly into a synapse, only to again move away deftly like leaves distracted by an abrupt and heavy wind. But we know it's all a masquerade, our cat-like pivot, as we strain to unlock the sanctuary of each other's gaze, turning on an unwilling pause and away from what we're drawn to, because what we long for is a rippling shatter, a cascade of pain.
Patty is a health psychologist working in a medical clinic in Chicago's Lawndale community. She is also an author who enjoys writing about spirituality, culture, justice, and other bizarre and beautiful intricacies of life. She recently did a TEDx talk focused on changing the narrative of inequity. You can find PJ at www.pjtemple.com. And now a poem from John M. Donovan. This is called The Carpenter's Legacy.
He tugged at his paint-stained cap with liver-spotted hands and braced himself against a tree across the street from where the wrecking ball was hanging, motionless on the crane, from the weighty burden of its bad deeds. Somewhere in town, the demolition crew had pork chops and baked beans and warm kitchens and gave no thought to their unfinished work at 216 Ocean Avenue. The tall brick corner of two walls rose into the pink twilight with one or more memories for each brick row. The old carpenter tugged at his cap and recalled the foreman's bushy eyebrows, the pickle loaf at lunch, the windy day girls in the 33 Fords, and playing baseball with apple cores and 2x4s. He He recalled the careful chalk lines, making nails disappear with a single blow, getting the joist just right, and walking away reluctantly at the end of the job, thinking it was good enough to live in himself. And now, with darkness closing in, there was no proof he'd ever been there, except the tree he leaned upon and the apples on the ground.
John is a writer and publisher with Hillsboro Publishing, LLC. I found this note on his website. He says, "I've been writing fiction all my life, but I didn't hit my stride until my late 40s. And by that time, I was tired of playing the game, approaching agents with cap in hand, asking them to please take a look at my latest manuscript. We don't get that many years on this planet, so I figured the fastest way to get my novels in the hands of readers would be to publish them myself. And thus, Hillsboro Publishing was born. I can promise that any book offered on this site will be honest, entertaining, and well worth your time." www.hillsboropublishing.com. Now I'd like to feature a piece of flash fiction by Brett Pribble. Brett is the editor of Ghost Parachute, an online literary journal, and I'll tell you more about that shortly. But let's hear the piece of fiction first. This is called The Last Supper. Strapped to a board with needles in his arms, Hubert still tasted chicken parmesan. He smiled at his reflection in the plexiglass mirror, horrifying the onlookers on the other side. It wasn't to gloat or scare them. He shed such impulses long ago. It was the marinara sauce. Licking droplets on his back teeth, he basked in it. Before they checked his anal cavity and handcuffed his arms and legs, Hubert met with a priest. He didn't find Jesus. The only deliverance he received in his final hours came from garlic bread, green beans, and cauliflower, the sides of his savory savior. Hubert couldn't wrap his mind around it. He'd spent the last 16 years alone in a cell the size of a parking lot space, and not once did anyone do something nice for him. Were they doing it for him or for themselves? Did it make them feel better about taking his life? Did it prevent them from becoming a murderer like him? Hubert never served a fancy meal to that bank teller before pulling the trigger. He killed people the wrong way. It was the same meal his mother made him as a child, the same that he shared every other week with his fiancée, Tricia. Both of them were gone now. Only the taste remained. When the warden asked him if he had any last words before a lethal combination of drugs would surge through his veins and stop his heart, he tasted his lips once more. Memories flooded him. Then, in what would be misconstrued by the local paper as the parting words of a depraved psychopath, he said, "It was delicious." This piece was published in Bending Genres, April 6, 2018. Brett Pribble is the editor-in-chief of Ghost Parachute and is on the board of directors of the Kerouac Project Writer-in-Residence Program. His work has appeared in such places as Aquifer, the Florida Review Online, Stirring, a literary collection, Saw Palm, The Molotov Cocktail, Crack the Spine, and The Argonaut. Follow him on Twitter at Brett Pribble. Recently, Ghost Parachute published a blog post of mine called Creative Activism, Ideas for the Maladjusted. And I wanted to share a little bit of that with you today. Recently, the 50th anniversary of the death of the great Martin Luther King Jr. led us all to remember him and to take up again his spirit of activism. He is a hero to me not only as a spiritual activist, but also as a creative activist. He had pride in his self-described maladjustment. He envisioned an organization devoted to its creative expression, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. Men and women, he said, who will be as maladjusted as the prophet Amos. Amos fought for social justice, as did Jesus, Muhammad, and Buddha. He was grieved by inequality, by excessive wealth that existed alongside extreme poverty. Such prophets, inspired teachers, still exist among us. I have been following the spiritual activism of John Pavlovitz, who challenges the haughty and stubborn members of the white evangelical crowd to remember compassion, sensitivity, and above all, the love that is inherent in the Christian faith. I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, and in the past few years have become more frustrated and disappointed than ever by its support for the current president during and after the election. Therefore, I am drawn to spiritual and creative activists. Here are some characteristics of creative activism. It begins with fierce love. What are you devoted to? You don't have to be everything to everyone, and you don't have to fight every fight. Are you interested in prison reform, literacy, women's rights, or other civil liberties? Something else? It encourages individual choice of expression. If you are uncomfortable with marches and protest signs, what are the gifts and talents you can use in creative resistance? Also, creative activism engages and cooperates with others who are working to achieve similar goals. I had the honor to be involved with a project called Love is Love, for example, and I became a voice for poets. What about you, my friend? Give your words and your voice to a creative adventure that speaks of your own courage, commitment, and connection. Find your art, your means of expression. If you are one of the maladjusted, let your creative efforts be your testimonial and your transition to creative activism. Whatever you do, be bold. I'd love to hear about what you've got going. You can write me at Tamara Miles SC on Twitter or at TamaraMilesSC@gmail.com. Now I'd like to share something by Louisa Campbell. This is published in Algebra of Owls, June 22nd, 2017. The poem is called We Don't Know What to Do with the Dead Things. Skin them, chop them, stuff them in a pie. Boil them up with vegetables. Put them on to fry. Take them to a taxidermist. Pose them in glass cases. Use their hides for furry hats, but don't look at their faces. Dress them up in pretty clothes and lay them down in boxes. Bury them deep underground to save them from the foxes. Stick their heads on wooden poles outside the city gate. Add some colored circles and display them in the Tate. Drop them in the deepest sea in a lead-lined coffin. Donate them to the lab to be dissected by a boffin. Seal them up in pyramids with hoards of golden treasure. Put them in a carriage drawn by horses wearing feathers. Stand them up in catacombs. Sing a hymn of sorrow. Or chuck them in the freezer now and work it out tomorrow. Louisa Campbell hangs around English spa towns. A psychiatric nurse in the past, she now has a bizarre illness, so she writes and adopts stray dogs. She has realized that life is silly but important, and she is very happy about that. Have you ever wondered how to comment on somebody else's poetry? Maybe you don't know exactly what to say, but you'd like to offer support. Dave Kavanaugh, one of the editors of the Blue Nib literary magazine, recently posted a blog called Commenting on Poetry. Let me tell you what he says about this task. He writes, "Okay, so I get it. There are some scary moments when it comes to commenting on the work of other poets, like fearing that your comments may not be appreciated or indeed helpful, or that they may be interpreted as harsh or judgmental. But hey, a comment is your opinion, and let me assure you that a writer would rather hear your critique than hear nothing." Similar to the short story, poetry is one of those rare, once-in-a-blue-moon genres that readers enjoy but may not be entirely confident in how to approach. And here are some of his tips. Number one, metaphors. Focusing on the use of metaphors and symbolic images within a poem is a good starting point. Do the metaphors make sense? Are there perhaps contradictory metaphors or separate metaphors that work together well within the piece that you could point out to the writer? Number two, the center of the poem. When reading a poem, it is a good idea to look out for the center of the poem. The metaphors pointed out above will help you work this out. And indeed, it is true to say that a poem can be interpreted in multiple ways. But there is almost always a central, prevailing theme that drives the piece. An idea or a theme on which the poet relies to pull the piece together. If you see these connections, then tell the poet. He or she will be glad that you connected with their work. Number three, descriptive language and imagery. Poetry should evoke an image through its use of words. While much can be ambiguous and ends up being left to interpretation, the language should read descriptively enough to provide various meanings to the overall content of the piece. Suggestions and your own interpretations of the poem will make up the content of a worthwhile comment. Positive feedback is, of course, as much appreciated as constructive criticism is. So don't be afraid to submit a short comment telling the poet how much you enjoyed his or her work. If you'd like to read more from Dave Kavanaugh's article, you can visit it at The Blue Nib. It's magazine.thebluenib.com. I recently had a poem published in The Blue Nib myself, so I'll share that one with you. It's a sad poem about a young woman whose life ended much too soon due to suicide. This is in the voice of August Ames, and the poem is called Porn Star August Ames Found Dead of Suspected Suicide at 23. I was tricked by tongues early, a grandfather who took his pleasure in twisted teaching. And this I learned too well in time. My body was more yours than mine. My mind went dark, I thought. A better therapist, I thought. More talk. Less mindless repetition of titillating movements. I moved to Twitter for more hands. These typed. They took me for a toy dog. Barking. In that same issue of the Blue Nib, there's a poem called She Loves Him, She Really Does, and He Loves Her, So What More Could She Ask? Poet's name is Tracy A. Clapper, and she's from Charleston, South Carolina. She is on a journey, she says, to heal myself and anyone else who crosses my path. I'm a seeker, a mom, a wife, a friend, a birder, and a poet. I seek connection with the divine feminine, all of nature, and humans who truly see me and accept me as I am. Writing facilitates the evolution of my soul in a way that nothing else provides. Here's her poem. The cashier has her three daughters' names tattooed with neon pink flowers encircling them on the back side of her forearm above the wrist. Black plastic gems glitter around a cheap bracelet dangling over the hand that reaches out from the tattoo. She chews pink bubblegum, switches it from side to side in between pops, and lives in a trailer with the last man who smiled at a not very funny joke she made. Next up is a poem called La Casa Femenina, and it's by Cristina Rivera Garza. Translated from the Spanish by Julia Leverón, published in Gulf Coast, a journal of literature and fine arts. And today it will be read by my friend Chris McElroy, who is a biology teacher and a Spanish speaker. I'll follow this reading with the English version.
La casa femenina. Anoche soné la casa donde no vivo y no poseo. Tenía los muros azules y una membrana de membrillo en lugar de techo. Olía hierba fresca a pies de muchacha sumergidos en el río. La luz de los quinques alumbraba el sosegado vuelo de los insectos. La llama estío porque me exigió un hombre a gritos. Y entré en ella como se entre a veces en el sexto. Sin dudar y sin saber y sin pensar en los orificios. Era lleno de aire adentro. Vi a través de las 13 ventanas lo que se quedaba afuera. El mundo ensimismado en su propio espejo. La edad lógica y absoluta donde todo es velocidad. La dictadura de los significados. La perfecta perpetuidad del hospital. Me di la vuelta y toqué el piso, la mesa, la cama. Me acurqué bajo la cintura de su sombra. Entonces el placer que es la felicidad me untó los muslos con su gasa. Estuve frente a frente con las paz.
The Feminine House. Last night I dreamt of the house where I don't live and don't possess. It had blue walls and a membrane of quince instead of a roof. It smelled of fresh herbs, a woman's feet submerged in the river. The light of the lanterns illuminated the tranquil arcs of insects. I called it a summer home because it screamed to me to name it, and I entered it like one enters sometimes into sex, without doubting and without knowing and without considering orifices. Air filled with air. Interior. I saw through the 13 windows what stayed outside, the world absorbed in its own image, the logical and absolute age where everything is velocity, a dictatorship of significance, the perfect tidiness of hospitals. I turned around and touched the floor, the table, the bed. I curled up in the waste of their shadows. Then the pleasure that is happiness spread its gauze over my thighs. I was face to face with peace. Leverone is an instructor of poetry and Spanish at UT Dallas. She holds a recent PhD in comparative literature and an MFA in poetry. She translates from the Spanish. Her renderings of poems by Paco Irondo have appeared in magazines including Witness and the Boston Review and are forthcoming as a book of selected translations, Fuel and Fire, from Diálogos Press. Her first chapbook, Shouldering, emerged in 2016, and a second, Little Escape, won the 2016 Claudia Emerson Poetry Chapbook Award and is forthcoming from JMWW. She is the editor of Sakura Review. Thinking about the feminine house and the whole idea of what makes a home returns me to a passage written by my friend Karen Edmondson Bims in her blog. She wrote, "This is a busy week in Bimsland. My youngest son graduates from high school. For those with younger children, the quote that the days are long but the years fly by is true. I am the parent of three adult children now and remember when that day felt so far away. The week is filled with senior activities for my son and party prep for me. We have family flying in and a party Saturday afternoon. We have a funeral in the mix as well because one of my husband's two uncles passed away late last week. He will be missed, but he lived a full and happy life, and in our beliefs, he is reunited with the woman he loved and many other beloved family members, which makes it easier for us to say goodbye. With everything going on, my emotions can get on a roller coaster as well. I've felt frustrated, sad, happy, and proud this week. If I let the emotions take over, it's exhausting. So I'm starting each day with the intention to live it the best I can, to be as kind to myself and others as I can, and to let go of the negative voices that tell me I'll never be ready in time, or no one is coming to my party, or my house isn't good enough to host a party like this. So instead of letting the doubt get to me, I am affirming the following. This party is for my son, and we will celebrate with whoever shows up. If people come to judge me in my house, it won't matter what my house looks like. They'll judge anyway. I've thrown so many parties of every size, and ready is a relative term. We'll have food and fun regardless of what gets done. While I want our home to be warm and welcoming, the real focus is celebrating my son, the graduate, who came a long way to get to this point in his life. You can read more from Karen at her blog called Moving Toward Better. By a friend of my daughter's who's studying poetry in college. Her name is Tasha Borst. Tasha lives in Wellington, New Zealand with her two baby bunnies. She is studying English at Massey University and wrote this piece for her creative writing class. One day she hopes to make a living writing fairy tales, but will settle for another Disney World trip in the meantime. Her poem is called Ringed in Fire. Her lips ringed in fire, spit words with jagged teeth and reaching fingers. They crawl ink black and hungry for the space you left, held at bay only by the faintest rustle of a hard-worn prayer. I will be the earth, the sacred ground, sun warmed and brown, and hold close the space where you rest until the orchids that make your bed sprout through my skin. Members of the Curiosity Salon on Facebook, which is an online creativity group that I administrate, is Wanda Conway. And she has written a couple of pieces just a few days ago. And I want to share this with you. This one's called Since You Asked. The girl with the busy mind is having problems keeping the busy part busy. Her mind drifts and drifts to places she has not visited in many moons. Her mind drifts to places in the heart that have been locked away. She wonders if it is safe to peek into those dark chambers. She fears what she might find there. The broken pieces are the softness that is there. The softness that has been hidden away, the forgotten pieces, she wonders. The girl is strong and tough. She has fought many battles and she has won. She found her safe place and has resided there and found peace there. The peace that has made her what she is today, behind those walls and barriers. The girl wonders what love means. Love is just a four-letter word, four little letters. Such powerful little letters they are, with great meaning that can change a heart, the world, and move mountains. Love, does it make the world go around? Salon recently posted a quote from William Sutar. I bleed myself to be your drink. Is not the blood of poets ink? Thank you, Joan Granger. What a marvelous quote. Another quote to encourage you today from Skip Bolden. Found this on Twitter. The secret is not to give up hope. It's very hard not to, because if you're really doing something worthwhile, I think you will be pushed to the brink of hopelessness before you come through the other side. I listened recently to a TED Talk by Carolyn McHugh, and I remembered that my friend Jane Barry had shared it with me a few years ago. It was good to see it again. It's called The Art of Being Yourself. I just want to share a little bit of that recording with you today.
Shave, or you combed your hair, or maybe you checked your teeth for spinach after lunch. But what you didn't know is that the face looking back at you isn't the face that everybody else sees. It's a kind of reversed, distorted, back to front image. So some years ago I was on a flight to New York and I read an article in the FT, and it was an article about a phenomenon called a true mirror. And for the Americans listening, that's a mirror. So the true mirror was actually invented by a brother and sister team in New York called John and Catherine Walters. And what they discovered was that if you take two mirrors and you put them together at right angles and you take the seam away, the images bounce off each other. And what you see when you look in a true mirror is exactly what other people see when they look at you. So I land in New York and I phone John up and ask him if I can go and see him. And I end up in his gallery in Brooklyn. And it was like being a sideshow in the circus. There were true mirrors, full length, face size, all over this gallery. And when I walked over to the true mirror for the first time and I looked in the mirror, it was one of the most disorientating experiences I've ever had in my life. The first thing you notice when you look in a true mirror is that your head's not on straight. So yours is kind of going that way, and yours is quite straight actually, and yours is going that way a wee bit. So apparently most of us tilt our heads one way or another. So when you approach a true mirror, the first thing you try and do is fix your head, but of course, because it's reversed, you go the wrong way. So it's very, very disorientating. But more importantly, I had a flashback. I had a flashback to when I was a wee girl. So I grew up in Glasgow. In case you haven't noticed, I am Scottish. But I grew up in Glasgow, and my mum, when she was putting her makeup on, I used to love sitting watching my mum putting her makeup on, you know, with my chin in my hands. And I would tell her occasionally, isn't it funny how one side of your top lip is higher than the other side of your top lip? And she'd look in the mirror and she'd say, it is, no. And I'd say, no, it's only a couple of millimetres, but that side of your Cupid's bow is definitely higher than the other side of your Cupid's bow. She'd say, Caroline, you're havering. And when I looked in the true mirror, there was the lip that I had been wearing at that time for maybe 45 years, and I'd never seen it. So the difference is, when you look in a regular mirror, you look for reassurance. You look for reassurance that you're beautiful, or you're young, or you're tidy, or your bum doesn't look big in that. But when you look in a true mirror, you don't look at yourself. You look for yourself. You look for revelation, not for reassurance. And this was deeply interesting to me, because what I do for a living is I help people be themselves, not in any narcissistic or solipsistic way, but because I believe that social reformation begins, always starts with the individual. And when you look at remarkable individuals, and when I say remarkable or successful individuals, I don't mean monetarily successful. I mean people that have been successful at achieving whatever they set out to do. You'll find that the thing they have in common is they have nothing in common. These are people who, you know, work in many of the fields that I work in. I work with people in corporations, I work with captains of industry, I work with selected politicians, I work with geophysicists, I work with chamber orchestras and ballet dancers and pop stars and opera singers. And I've identified the thread that links them. These are individuals who've managed to figure out the unique gift that the universe gave them when they incarnated, and then put that at the service of their goals. I think that we all come complete. We come complete with one true note we were destined to sing. And these are people that have managed to figure that out.
I've had the good fortune to be involved in a project, a book, a collection of tales of traveling while female. The book is called My Wandering Uterus. It's edited by K.A. Lady, with a foreword by H. Byron Ballard. My copy arrived this week, and I immediately dived into a narrative by Dawn Reno Langley called Wearing the Shellwater Kameez. It's about her trip to Islamabad as a Fulbright scholar. It's so beautiful. I just want to read this one section. This is from part 5. And it begins, when you arrive in Islamabad, you settle your suitcase on a double bed in the mahogany paneled bedroom in the Fulbright house. Your chest thrums with your pulse. Your ears buzz as if you've had too much caffeine. You've been traveling for 26 hours, and if you don't sleep soon, you'll collapse, probably knocking your head on the large bureau. A vase filled with yellow and orange summer flowers sits on the bureau. It is the first of many bouquets you'll receive while in Islamabad, but you don't know that yet. There is much you don't know. Moving to the tiny bathroom, you splash your face with tepid water, brush your teeth, trying to ignore the ringing in your ears, then realize with a start that it is not ringing at all. Someone is singing. You turn off the water and move below the tiny window above your head. And in the pre-dawn stillness, a deep voice intones the call to prayer. You've heard it before, in movies, on television, in news reports. It's always been foreign, strange, and somewhat scary. From a different direction, another voice chimes in. You stretch your neck to hear more clearly. Then another voice, a closer sound, and another, and another. It is a symphony of prayers, as if all the holy men timed their prayers to create a concert just for you. The sound mesmerizes, and its beauty fills your eyes with tears. You stand there listening with every molecule in your body until the calls stop as they started, one at a time.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمدا رسول الله.
Over the next few days, you hear those prayers 5 times a day. Before the sun comes up in the morning, at lunchtime, in the middle of the afternoon, near dinner, and at night. But the call to prayer is never more haunting and beautiful than it is during that quietest time before dawn. You find yourself wandering to the roof to hear the call and gaze out over the dark shadows of Islamabad, spotting the silhouetted mosques, and then trying to match each call with the appropriate mosque. Then one day, during midday prayers, you have company. If you want to read more of her narrative, please visit Amazon and look for My Wandering Uterus, Tales of Traveling While Female. And you'll also find one of my poems inside. It's called My Uterus Didn't Wander. And I may read that one for you another day. I think I've mentioned before that I'm kind of obsessed with missing persons cases. And recently, just last week in fact, something very unusual happened to me. I had discovered, purely by accident, the music of a band called Frightened Rabbit and the lead singer, Scott Hutchison. I'd run across it while just looking for some new music on the web, and I became overwhelmed by the beauty of one piece called Die Like a Rich Boy. I played it over and over and over a dozen times that day. And the next morning I got up and started playing it again. And I thought, I'd like to know more about this singer. So I looked for his name in Google and was absolutely shocked to find that he had gone missing the night before. Sadly, Scott Hutchison took his own life. I want to encourage you today, if you're feeling lost and alone, if you're feeling that nothing can ever be good again, there can never be any more hope, hold on one more day. Scott left a legacy behind. I want you to hear this. I hope its beauty makes you want to stay around and hear the next beautiful piece of art that somebody produces.
in a loaded these you'll finally have beneath my key. I wanna die like a rich boy diving in a hydrocodone dream. You can die like a rich girl by me, or have the magazines will grieve. I wanna die like a rich boy bathing in a milk bath I could drown. I wanna die like a rich boy, even if we're as poor as we are now. I wanna die like a rich boy drowning in a lake that bears my name. You can die like a rich girl by me, flushed and radiant with fame. I wanna lie and sleep on the TV in a golden cardboard crown. I wanna die like a rich boy, even if we're as poor as we are now. Us in. I'll be Shakespeare's moonstruck king. We can lose our minds at the top of the hill. We burn cash and carry a decadent flame into the night beyond the green.
In memory of Scott Hutchison. Friends, we're out of time for the day. I'll see you soon. Many blessings. Hold on to hope. With DJ Tamara on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.